From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. It is time for our monthly science roundtable here, and a few housekeeping notes as we start our second hour today. First of all, it's our first Monday broadcasting, simulcasting on WRUR 88.5 FM in Rochester, and we're thrilled to be on 88.5 FM. So you can find us whether you're in Rochester or the Rochester area, 88.5 on the FM dial, or all the way throughout the Finger Lakes, all the way to Ithaca, 89.5 FM, 89.5 on Finger Lakes Public Radio. So you can find us on a number of different channels now, and we're thrilled about that. And this week, you're going to be hearing from a number of guests in the University of Rochester family. We should also tell you that we had to shift a few things because of some breaking news and events coverage for a number of reasons. For our listeners who were asking, last hour, we were scheduled to be on with Neil Conan and Ken Rudin, the Political Junkie, NPR veterans. They'll be coming to Rochester in about 3 weeks for a public event. Their roadshow is coming here. And because of the news on the Glazers and our coverage last hour, we had to move that interview. We expect to have it, we hope, next week sometime. But we'll certainly let you know on that. Also, Lieutenant Governor candidate Kathy Hochul took the time to join us on this program. And you're going to hear that interview in full tomorrow. You'll hear it on the website and also in full tomorrow. We've been playing chunks of it for the last few days, but you'll hear the full interview with Lieutenant Governor candidate Kathy Hochul, who was kind enough to take the time to join us. You will hear that tomorrow as we preview primary day. So let's get to our science roundtable now that we've got a full panel here. And it's mostly University of Rochester, but there's a little cross-pollination, which is always exciting. We have from RIT, Sukanya Chakrabarty is here. She's from the School of Physics and Astronomy at RIT. Nice to see you, Dr. Chakrabarty.
Thank you for having me.
Are we going to be talking dark matter, I hope? Can I ask you some dark matter questions?
Of course.
We're going to have some fun this hour. And our listeners, our regular listeners of the Science Roundtable, know that we have talked at length about dark matter and all of my geeky questions about dark matter in the past. So I'm going to be very curious to hear Dr. Chakrabarty's views on dark matter. We also have Richard Eisenberg. Rich is a professor of chemistry, editor-in-chief for Inorganic Chemistry, and has done plenty of work on hydrogen, among many other things. Nice to see you.
Great to be here, and it's going to be a lot of fun to talk about hydrogen, which, in talking with Sukanya before, is probably the most abundant element in the universe.
Everybody thinks it's always fun to talk about hydrogen. Every
right.
party I go to, we can only talk about hydrogen, it seems. Thank you very much for being here, Professor Eisenberg. We also have John Kessler of the John Kessler Lab at the University of Rochester. And you might have seen some news headlines recently reading about a number of things. First of all, going back to 2010 with the oil spill it was a Deep Horizon oil spill.
That's correct.
So you've done some work kind of analyzing changes over time, microorganisms and the like. We're going to be talking about that. But also, the most immediate piece of news out of all of this is you might have seen the story in the New York Times on methane seepage. And Dr. Kessler, methane seepage where?
This most recent expedition was in the northeast U.S. margin. We took an expedition out this summer, departed out of Rhode Island, and we're looking at some methane bubbles that were coming out of the seafloor in the Hudson Canyon. So kind of between the New Jersey and New York continental margin.
Continental margin of the seafloor. How far below the surface?
We were about 500 meters below the surface where we were at, so roughly a third of a mile.
And so methane seepage, in my knowledge of it, I know nothing about methane seepage, but there's a couple questions about that. First of all, the significance of methane in general, and then the question of how long it's been happening. What I read is that methane seepage has probably been going on for 1,000 years or more, but what's the significance of looking at it now?
Those are all very good questions. And there's many different ways in which we can look at this problem and what motivates people to study them. I would say, chronologically speaking, people have seen these bubbles really coming out of the seafloor for decades. And I'd say in the early days of prospecting for oil and natural gas off the coasts of continents, people looked for just these signals, methane bubbles coming out of the seafloor as evidence for the potential for larger geologic reservoirs of oil and natural gas, places where they could go and do some more detailed geochemical analyses to see the potential for those sorts of things. Now, my particular interest in this is that methane itself is a rather potent greenhouse gas. This specific release of methane, oceanic methane, is one that humans don't have a direct influence on. But it nonetheless is one where there are some radical hypotheses out there that changes in ocean temperature and circulation patterns could promote larger releases of these bubbles from the seafloor. And if they eventually propagate up to the atmosphere, that then there could be an exacerbation of warming. And so really what our goal is, has always been, is to go out and really put some numbers on these radical hypotheses. Is this just a scary bedtime story, or is there some validity to this?
Fascinating stuff. And my limited understanding of methane, hopefully you can help us sort of flesh out some more things about methane. First of all, when we talk about energy production, for an example, this is just an example. I've heard a hydrologist at Syracuse University debate with geolimnologists at Cornell about how much methane gets released, for example, in hydrofracking. And what I often hear is that methane is short-lived, or in I don't know if that's the right description of it, John, but give me a sense from what do we, when we talk about methane, what does that mean when we say it's short-lived?
I believe that generally what people are referring to in that sense are its lifetime in the atmosphere. If we're emitting carbon dioxide, for example, the lifetime of a carbon dioxide atom is much longer in the atmosphere than that of methane. Methane's a little less than a decade that a typical molecule will reside in the atmosphere before ultimately it's converted, and it's ultimate product from that conversion is actually carbon dioxide.
So methane converts to carbon dioxide.
That's correct. It will be slowly oxidized over a decade, converting it ultimately to carbon dioxide, which is a less potent greenhouse gas. Now, methane itself is substantially more potent than CO2 on a molecule-by-molecule basis. But we really need to look at this from a variety of perspectives, because we're not really just looking at it on a molecule-by-molecule basis. When we're talking about warming the atmosphere, we need to take into effect timescales. So are we talking about a 10-year timescale, a 50-year timescale, 100,000-year timescale? Because ultimately then each of those different molecules will warm on different patterns.
Okay. And when it comes to methane, I think what those of us who are not from a scientific background, when we think about energy, when we think about gas in the atmosphere, the mistake we make is we may think, well, they're burning coal, but the coal's burned, it's gone. You know, as if it's you burn something and there's no resultant, you know, it becomes something, right? And we have a hard time kind of getting our heads around that. Similarly with methane, if we hear it's short-lasting, for example, we hear energy debates, but well, it's short-lasting. The easy thing for us to think of it is, well, it's gone. It lasts for a little while, then it's gone. So it's more potent than CO2, and it converts to CO2, but that doesn't mean that there's no impact, right? That doesn't mean that there's no potential impact, even if it converts to CO2.
Not at all. The gases right now that are influencing the temperature of the atmosphere. And let me back up for a second by saying the greenhouse effect that we're so interested in studying in the modern environment from energy production is one that is a 100% a natural process. The temperature of the planet, life as we know it, would not be what it is without this natural greenhouse effect. Where people are so concerned is if we are exacerbating this effect to a point that could substantially influence climate and weather and other types of patterns that we're so accustomed to as we live. Now, that said, when we are converting one thing to the next, be it coal to CO2, methane to carbon dioxide, really the way that I like to look at this as gears on a clock. It's a completely natural process. If we are talking about plants, we're talking about trees, things that have absolutely no connection with a human being whatsoever. A tree falls in the woods, it starts to decay. That plant matter will be ultimately converted to CO2. But the cycles in which those that carbon, if we follow that carbon atom going from that plant material to something in the atmosphere, and ultimately that CO2 in the atmosphere going back down into the plant material, let's say through a photosynthetic process, all of those are connected on timescales that are relatively short. When we talk about now taking oil from deep geologic reservoirs, coal as well, and burning that then through oil product or energy production types of processes, that really speeds up these cycles. It takes a geologic cycle that takes carbon on much longer time scales, sequestering it below the ground. Basically, it's a massive gear on a clock that's turning incredibly slowly, not a really small gear that's turning really quickly. And it's speeding that gear up, taking it out, burning it in a very efficient way, and converting it to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The same thing is true with methane as well. It could be a natural process of methane being released from the seafloor, or something that, who knows, might be accelerating due to ocean warming or agricultural processes, be it cattle, sheep agriculture, rice agriculture, are all known emissions of methane to the atmosphere. Hydrofracking is also suspected as a source of methane to the atmosphere. When we convert these things to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, we have to look at the gears of this clock, not only the extraction of that carbon from deeper geologic reservoirs in that slow turn process that's speeding that up, but also once that carbon goes into the atmosphere, and where does it go after that? Where does that gear turn? And again, we can think of it very much as taking that carbon out of the atmosphere and photosynthesizing it in the terrestrial range on land. But there are also this straight process of dissolving gases like carbon dioxide in water. It's very common for us to open a beer, a bottle of champagne, some soda, and we see bubbles coming out. Gases dissolve in liquid very readily. And so the dissolution of CO2 from the atmosphere into oceans is also a substantial way of watching a process that's seemingly invisible, as you suggest, mm-hmm. Something where we're converting something and it's not disappearing, but nonetheless, and watching that that molecule that both be converted photosynthetically as well as through some physical chemical processes of having it dissolve in water.
It's our monthly science roundtable, and before I broaden the conversation to the other members of the panel, I want to ask John Kessler of the University of Rochester just about how you measure this now. What's the actual mechanism for the next step here, looking at methane seeps, as they're called? How do you actually go about this now? What are you looking for?
That's a great question, because studying oceanography, especially processes that occur on the seafloor, is one of the most inaccessible environments. So how do we go out? How do we study something that covers 70% of the surface of our planet in any meaningful way where we can make generalizations that are going on in such a large region? And that is ultimately one of the biggest challenges we have. Myself, personally, I am a field-going oceanographer, so at least once a year normally, I'll go out on a research vessel. They're normally owned, operated by the federal government for just this purpose. They are floating laboratories. There's everything from just a normal laboratory bench like you'd expect in any university to specialized vehicles that are either manned or unmanned that allow us to go to the seafloor, collect samples of water at precise depths, either make those measurements in situ, that would be obviously the best way, but sometimes the analyses are a little too sophisticated and we have to bring samples back to the lab. We can do those, some of them analyses right there on the ship. Other ones, we need to bring samples back to the laboratory here at home to make those types of those analyses. But ultimately, there's people like myself all over the planet making these types of analyses. We try to put them together in a mathematical model to do some global extrapolations and really try to get a better understanding, not just on the local environment that we're looking at, but how this plays out in a global context.
All right, and so this is probably too pat a question, but when you start to look at methane, if we're seeing more methane, I guess, is that kind of a possibility? We could be seeing more methane being released in these seeps. If X, then Y. You know, that's too pat kind of a question, but is there kind of a formulation that we think going forward we can start to draw conclusions?
Ideally, yes. The problem
this is always a dangerous question.
It's an incredibly dangerous question, mainly because we have such a large area, number one, of different seafloor environments influenced by different processes. And number two, you know, one of the things that motivates my research, that motivates a lot of people, is the most recent change in atmospheric temperature. And if that's going to influence in any way, shape, or form some of these natural processes like we're studying. But there's also a lot of natural variation that's mm-hmm. going on in the planet. So separating off natural versus man-made change is next to impossible. One of the glorious things about this recent discovery, say, of seeps off the east coast of the United States is it's a great area that strips off a lot of these superfluous variables and gets us down to only a couple where if we can design and operate some systematic studies, we may be able to start to tease out some of the natural as well as the anthropogenic factors that might influence seafloor processes.
Okay. It's going to take some time.
A little bit.
Well, we'll certainly be following that. But I think a lot of people will appreciate hearing that it is very difficult to get variable free. I mean, to really reduce all of the variables that may be sort of clouding the data. And that's why I find the methane seepage so interesting. So, okay. So now you've got to look at how research is going on there regarding methane seeps and potential warming. I see the phone's ringing. If you have any questions over anything you hear throughout the roundtable, you can jump in at 844-295-TALK, toll-free 844-295-8255, or right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can also join the conversation at any time on Twitter, at Evan Dawson. Maybe a good way to transition our conversation is to bring Bud from Chi Lai. He's on the phone, and he's got a different kind of a question. Bud from Chi Lai, thanks for calling. Go ahead, Bud.
Hi. I'm very interested in methane, but I just wanted to point out, I'm a graduate of U of R from 1961 in mechanical engineering, and I know now that there's a course that students take on the ethical responsibility of debunking urban myths that come up all the time. And there's a lot of urban myths about methane. One of the things about methane that's great is you can use it to generate methanol alcohol, which would be better than ethanol as a gas additive in the immediate short term. But it also can be used to generate hydrogen for fuel cells. And I'm just wondering if you guys know about that and have done any thinking on that using of methanol.
Bud, thanks for the call. Let me turn it over to Professor Eisenberg on that. Go ahead.
Yes. The use of methane industrially now, besides for energy purposes, is actually for the production of methanol, in part, and for hydrogen. And in making methanol, what is done is the methane is turned into hydrogen and carbon monoxide, which are then combined into making of methanol. So that's a little bit complicated process that also leads to some loss in the intrinsic energy value of the methane. With regard to the making of hydrogen, we do that currently for the purposes of making ammonia. And that's done on a very large scale, but that's for the fertilizer that we need. And at the same time, if we consider the energy needs that we have rather than just the fertilizer needs, the energy needs are much, much greater. And in the long run, we have to be able to make hydrogen. Hydrogen, in my estimation, is the fuel of the future, but that has to be done using sunlight and water rather than using methane.
Okay. Do you want to weigh in on that one, John? You feel like that's been covered there.
Well, you know, the one thing that I've learned is to let the experts speak when there's an expert in the room. So I'm looking across the table at my colleague right now.
I have a very interesting dark matter question via Twitter. Before we get to that, I want to shift the energy camera, because if you're just joining us, our science roundtable is looking at, we're sort of generically calling it gas in many forms, if that's good enough, including space gas. That's maybe we're roping Ms. Chakrabarty in a little unfairly, but that's okay. But that's the Science Roundtable brings in different disciplines. And we want to move to solar energy systems. And Professor Eisenberg, Richard Eisenberg, a professor of chemistry at the University of Rochester, you've been working for decades on solar energy systems. But I am fascinated by what nanocrystals are doing here. Can you give me a sort of an outline first about what's been going on over a couple of decades, and now what this is telling us?
Well, one of the ongoing challenges we have is actually how do we generate energy that we can use at home and in our cars. And we can think about things such as methane or oil or perhaps coal as a source of energy because we can burn that. But the one source of energy that will be able to burn, if you will, without producing any carbon dioxide is hydrogen. And people have known this for a long time, and people have worked on it for quite some time. In my own laboratory, we've been working on making hydrogen from water using visible light. And in order to do that, you need to have something that is going to absorb the light, the visible light. Water, if you hold it up, and hopefully it's a good glass of Rochester water, it's going to be clear. It's not going to be colored. It doesn't absorb visible light. And so you need something to absorb the light. And these are the pigments in green plants, or they happen to be some of these nanocrystals, very, very small bits of matter that will absorb in the green part of the spectrum or the red part of the spectrum. And somehow we're able to use the energy that gets absorbed by these to initiate the process of making hydrogen.
Where do the nanocrystals come from?
Oh, if you mix, if these are nanocrystals of cadmium and selenium, selenide, as we call it, you mix together some cadmium salt and you mix together with it some selenium source. And these are recipes that we have, you can make cadmium selenide, you can make cadmium sulfide, you can make lead selenide. There are many of these different kinds of materials that we call semiconductors. And when we make these semiconductors in very, very small bits of matter on the order of nanometers, then they become nanocrystals. And they have special properties associated with them.
And so everybody wants to know about practical application and timelines. Can you talk about that?
Well, the practical application is part of what we're talking about. These compounds or these nanocrystals can absorb light and give off, they can luminesce, they can emit light, and they are being used as emissive detectors of different phenomena. But also, in this particular case that we're looking at, they will absorb light, and in doing so, you will get some really strong reducing agent, an electron, and some really good oxidant, a vacancy left behind. And I don't want to get too technical, so...
Okay. That's sort of what you're here to do. It's all right.
And so what you have is light comes in, and now you have something that, an electron that you can use to reduce a proton in water, a hydrogen atom in water. And so that means that you can get to H2. And on the other side, we need to oxidize water separately and get oxygen out, O2. And then you can run it through a fuel cell. And what you will get back is electrical energy and water. So you use sunlight plus water. You get hydrogen and oxygen. You take the hydrogen and oxygen, run it back through a fuel cell. You get water and you get work out. You get electrical energy. And that's really our mantra. That's the way we could avoid adding more carbon dioxide or greenhouse gases to the atmosphere.
This seems, to my lay mind, it seems absolutely remarkable in practice.
Well, it is. It will be.
It will be.
It will be. It's will a continuing be. Challenge to be able to do this on the scale that we need to do it.
Yeah.
But I think that we're within, 10, 15 years of being able to do it. Now, I should also mention that in California, they have tried to mandate zero emission vehicles. And one part involves electrical cars like Tesla. Mm-hmm. And the other part involves fuel cell cars. And in the fuel cell cars, they use hydrogen as their fuel. And they are building hydrogen fueling stations. And that hydrogen is generated now from natural gas. But within, I would hope, within 10 years, we're going to be generating that hydrogen using sunlight and water.
Every time we talk about energy, new development, new systems, scalability is always a question. And I guess that will, but again, 10 to 15 years of possibility. Every time we talk about solar energy,
scalability. That's absolutely right. But the encouraging part is that people have always talked about the infrastructure for the transportation of hydrogen and for the delivery of hydrogen to whatever it is that you're going to use it in. And here we in California, you actually have, I think, something like 12 hydrogen filling stations in the Los Angeles area, 3 or 4 in San Francisco, and it's projected that that number will triple in the next 5 years.
Let me get back to the phones. We've got John from Rochester who's called our Science Roundtable. Wow. Sorry about the feedback there, John. Hope your eardrums are okay.
I still have my eardrums.
There you go. I'm glad to hear that. Thanks for calling, John. Go ahead.
Professor, I was wondering, when we had the glaciers back 14,000 years ago or whatever, and they all melted pretty much, at least in Rochester, the cause of the melting, was that due to buildup of CO2 and methane in the atmosphere from some of the things that you're talking about, let's say from volcanoes or from some of these areas in the sea, that type of thing?
Well, I would just venture quickly that there is a natural fluctuation in CO2 levels in the atmosphere. John will respond more fully, but there are clear data that indicate that from the start of the Industrial Revolution about 150 years ago, that the amounts of CO2 in our atmosphere have increased over 40% just from man-dominated activity. And that level is going to increase even more in the next 30 years, to the point that I don't worry about myself, but I worry about my grandchildren and I worry about their children after them. So we're affecting the world in a significant way.
Now, will plant life, let's say if we decrease the amount of CO2 into the atmosphere, let's say in a perfect world, we're able to reduce man-made CO2 contribution dramatically, would this have an adverse effect on green plant life?
That's actually a really interesting question. If we look at just the simple photosynthesis equation, I think probably a lot of us saw in high school or something like that, we've got carbon dioxide and water and nutrients and light that come together to make organic matter. And I always like to think of it as, my weekend gardening that I do at home. And if I want my vegetables to grow, I better water them and I better fertilize them. And so it stands to reason that if we had a little bit more CO2 as well, that would have a fertilization effect. And so that's one of the things that people are studying right now. And I think that's where your question really lies. If we change the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, is that going to have a decrease? If we reduce some, is that going to decrease some of the photosynthetic activity as well? It turns out that in some places, that might have a little bit of an influence. But on many locations, the other variables such as sunlight, such as nutrients and water, are the dominating reactants, the dominating species in that process. So I don't think it's anticipated to be a big one.
Thank you very much for the call, John. It's our monthly Science Roundtable. When we come back, we're talking about how to map dark matter with Sukanya Chakrabarty from RIT, and she's going to handle what I think is, to date, the smartest Twitter question we've ever gotten. She hasn't heard it yet. But we're going to take the shortest break in radio. Glad to have a panel from University of Rochester and RIT as we talk gas in many forms and our monthly Science Roundtable. Stay with us. The first Monday of every month is our monthly science roundtable right here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and we have Professor Richard Eisenberg, along with John Kessler from the University of Rochester, and Sukanya Chakrabarty is with the School of Physics and Astronomy at the Rochester Institute of Technology. And Jake on Twitter says, when you get to dark matter and energy, please ask about modified Newtonian dynamics theory as an explanation to dark energy.
Sure. So,
is that a good way to lead off, Sukanya?
Of course. Absolutely.
I don't know what he's talking about, by the way.
He's talking about modifying the theory of gravity. So the standard theory of gravity was developed by Newton. And we have a lot of data in the solar system that confirms that very well. However, when you look at the very edges of galaxies, where things are moving at very low accelerations, Milgram in 1983 proposed modifying the theory of gravity to explain the observations of flat rotation curves in spiral galaxies. Now, let me actually explain what I mean by flat rotation curves. So what we're talking about here is looking at the circular speed of material as it's going around the galaxy. Now, if all the matter were simply due to the matter that you see in the stellar disk, you would have expected the circular speed to drop off as you go out to large distances from the galactic center. Okay. Now, in the 70s, when people made these observations of rotation curves in spiral galaxies, they saw that the circular speeds continued to be fairly constant out to large distances from the galactic center. Now, one possible explanation for that is that galaxies are surrounded by a dark matter halo, and that is what provides the support for these motions.
And we should probably, if we can just stop for one quick second and say that our listeners on this program may remember from last month, some of your own colleagues have debated whether dark matter exists at all, or not whether it exists at all, because, again, we're still looking for evidence of it. It's sort of fills a bit of a void in our understanding, but there's a question of whether we are thinking about it the right way. And so what's a quick give me a quick definition of dark matter.
Well, it's a hypothesized particle that doesn't emit electromagnetic radiation. However, it is massive. So I would say that the best way to go about detecting dark matter is by studying its gravitational effects on other bodies. So, I mean, a general theme here that we've been talking about is trying to understand processes that are not obvious by using various tracers. So John emphasized this, for example, when he was talking about climate change. Now, one analogy I like to use when talking about, you know, how we can study dark matter-dominated dwarf galaxies. Now, these are galaxies that are much smaller than our own, but are believed to be dominated by dark matter, is, you know, when you're looking at how they interact with the larger spiral galaxy itself, I myself look at the morphological disturbances in the outer gas disks of galaxies as a tracer of the perturbing effects of dwarf galaxies. So one analogy I like to mention in this context is in the 1800s, Le Verrier analyzed disturbances in the orbits of the then-known planet Uranus, and he made the hypothesis that they're due to a yet unseen planet. And he was able to calculate the azimuth or angle of that planet, which is now known as Neptune, to within a degree. So this is an example of how you can analyze the gravitational effects.
So this is why you have analogize the hunt for planets.
Sure.
With the hunt for dark matter. The current search for dark matter or search for understanding of dark matter is to you of a piece with the way they were simply trying to understand planets and find planets.
I would say so. Now, that's one example. The other, of course, very well-established way of mapping dark matter is, so what I talked about just now is dynamics. The other well-established way of characterizing dark matter is gravitational lensing. So when you look at the light from a background galaxy, it can be deflected as it's going around a massive object, and the amount of deflection is proportional to the mass. And we cannot explain, if all the matter were simply due to the visible matter that you see, we wouldn't be able to explain the amount of deflection.
But as David Merritt says, that is assuming that our current calculations are all good. And I mean, I think David Merritt has said maybe we need to look at sort of the way we understand other processes differently, that maybe dark matter isn't necessarily filling a void. Maybe we've made a mistake somewhere else. What do you think?
Well, you know, obviously mistakes are always possible, but one of, you know, one of the reasons why dark matter has become a major component of the reigning paradigm of structure formation in the universe is that without it, we're not able to explain the large-scale distribution of galaxies. Okay, now that's, I think, very well established, and there isn't anyone, even in the Mond community, who disputes that. Some of the dispute arises when we look on smaller scales. So that is not on scales of hundreds of megaparsec, but really on galactic and subgalactic scales. So some of that discrepancy may be due to our as yet incomplete understanding of galaxy formation. So the early simulations that were done of the formation of galaxies only included dark matter. However, galaxies are multi-component systems. They're made up not only of dark matter, but also stars, obviously, and of gas. So these things are baryons, are called baryons. And only recently in the last decade and last several years have we started to include the effects of these baryonic processes in some amount of realism in simulations. So it's still, you know, I would say that simulations of galaxy formation, in particular the inclusion of baryonic processes such as star formation, feedback from supernovae, and how they affect the life cycle of a galaxy, this is still very much in its infancy. Now, the other issue when it comes to resolving possible discrepancies between simulations from the standard theory of the reigning paradigm is the cold dark matter paradigm for structure formation in the universe, and observations, you know, I think it's very important to take into account selection effect.
And what do you mean by that?
So what I mean by that is, you know, in the last decade, because of very deep optical surveys from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, we've more than doubled the number of known dwarf galaxies. Okay. However, even this survey, it's an optical survey, it hasn't mapped the structure close to the disk of our galaxy. Okay.
And so by the way, a dwarf galaxy is smaller, only a few billion stars compared to...
So a typical dwarf galaxy is, say, has a mass that's about 1/100th or 1/1000th the mass of our own spiral galaxy. Some can only have, you know, or as, you know, as many stars as a single star cluster. Mm-hmm. So they can be very, very dim. And that's why I've been trying to develop an alternate method of characterizing them that doesn't rely on their optical light alone. But the point that I was making in terms of selection effects is that only a small fraction of the sky has been mapped to date by even the deepest optical surveys. Okay, so the region close to the disk of our galaxy, there's a lot of obscuring amount of dust and gas, so it's very hard to get at the structures close to the disk of our galaxy. So some of these discrepancies between simulations and observations may arise simply because the current state of observations is incomplete. Okay, so we need to take these selection effects into account, and it's not clear to me that the work that's been done, particularly in the Mond community, has done that effectively.
So what's next then? I mean, what we learned from some of your colleagues about a month ago was that we're at least getting much better at, at least the technology is getting better at sort of sorting through some of cosmic dust and helping us see, you know, 20 years ago, the pistol star was sort of hard to, it was a huge discovery. And now we're able to see a little bit more, for lack of a better term, deeply or more clearly into space. What's, What do you need next, and what will your work focus on?
Yeah, so I think there's really a tremendous amount of potential for discovery when we're looking at structures close to the plane of our galaxy at low latitudes. That area is largely unexplored at depth, and we could very well, with the next generation of deeper infrared surveys, you know, when you're looking in infrared light, the opacity is a lot less than in optical. So we should be able to probe deeper into the disk of our galaxy, and there may well be dozens of dwarf galaxies that we could discover lurking around the corner. So that's one possible resolution that is with more data. And of course, simulations are becoming more sophisticated these days. So in principle, we should be able to model these processes and more adequately and more realistically be able to account for their effects. So that's another proposed solution to some of the discrepancies. And yet another, of course, is modifying the theory of gravity on large scales.
Mark online says, your guest said some galaxies are dominated by dark matter. Why isn't our galaxy dominated by dark matter?
Well, so this, it comes from observations. So we are looking at the rotation curves of spiral galaxies, and that gives us a sense of how much dark matter you have in addition to the visible matter. So a typical spiral galaxy like our own, the stellar surface density drops off exponentially beyond the scale length. The scale length is on the order of a few kiloparsec. So that's 1,000 parsec. A parsec is a light year. So the typical galaxies are thousands of light years across. And so, I mean, this is basically an observational fact that dark matter, the dwarf galaxies tend to be more dark matter dominated than spirals.
So we've got gas in many different forms in this program, and we've got about 10 minutes left. In this week's, this month's Monthly Science Roundtable with a couple of guests. Sukanya Chakrabarty is from Rochester School, Rochester Institute of Technology, the School of Physics and Astronomy. Richard Eisenberg is a professor of chemistry and the editor-in-chief for Inorganic Chemistry. He's with the University of Rochester. John Kessler has a lab named after him, as some of his colleagues do at the University of Rochester, at the John Kessler Lab. And let me just at least also ask John, because we talked about methane seeps with you. Let me also ask you about some of the work that you've done regarding the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, because I'm curious about that. You have been studying how, at least from my recollection of reading some of your work on that, you've been studying how gas and oil have been sort of impacted by microorganisms and how that's changed over time. Give me a sense for what you're looking at there.
That's a great question. So the work that I was brought up to do is much like we talked about earlier in this program. And my motivation is really to see how the release of this gas may change with changing climatic conditions. Is it going to increase? If so, where is that methane going to end up? What's its ultimate fate? A lot of this, we can go around to the planet and we can make some measurements. In certain locations, we might be able to extrapolate. But really, we're talking about very long-term processes here, and it's going to be a while until these play out in the dramatic way, at least that's what we think, that these scary bedtime stories start to say. Now, that said, when the Deepwater Horizon incident occurred in the spring, on Earth Day, ironically, of 2010, we looked at that incident from a variety of perspectives. There's a few rather interesting stories that are kind of sidebars. But after about a week of thinking about this, we came to the rather obvious conclusion that this is raw reservoir fluid that's being released. This is not your grandfather's oil spill, which was a tanker of a relatively refined product that was released to the environment. Instead, this was raw reservoir fluid. And as such, natural gas should be a dominant component of what was being released, methane being the largest component of natural gas in these systems. So at that point in time, we we were under the assumption that methane was a very large component was what was being released. Turned out that as far as the mass of materials, about 15% of the mass, it was by far the largest single molecule that was released from this event. So for us, naturally going around and studying places where oil and natural gas come out of the seafloor, we could lend our expertise to this event to get a little bit of an understanding on the fate, transport, and environmental impacts for some of the hydrocarbons that were released. At the same time, we could advance science in a very fundamental way by addressing, by conducting hypothesis-driven research and being able to conduct an experiment that the National Science Foundation would never have funded us to do.
Well, let's hope not.
Exactly. which is to see what the fate was of an enormous methane release into the oceans, one that we've never seen from the seafloor, hopefully we'll never see again, but ultimately may in some way, at least in some slight way, simulate one of what it might look like under these much more large catastrophic conditions. What we found was rather surprising. We expected some of that methane to propagate up to the atmosphere. We were in a much deeper environment at that location. We expected some of it to remain in the ocean waters and eventually diffuse out to the atmosphere. What we saw was that none of it diffused out to the atmospheres. It was trapped and then dissolved in waters roughly two-thirds of a mile below the sea surface. And within a relatively short time period, a few weeks to a few months, indigenous bacteria that live in the waters of the Gulf of Mexico came in and respired all of that released methane.
Respired.
That's correct.
Ate it? What did they do?
That's correct. Okay. I look at the process much like us eating an apple. We come through, we take that form of carbon, we get some energy out of it, and we expel CO2.
Okay, but what's the consequence of that? I mean, again, some of the optimists of the oil spill isn't as bad as we think crowd. We're saying microorganisms are going to help save the day. Are they?
They helped, and those people are not entirely wrong. But at the same time, we have to take a step back and recognize that this was easily the worst oil spill in U.S. waters. And even if some of those components were consumed by microorganisms and we did not have as thick of a gloppy mess on the beaches as we could have, number one, we still did. Number two, once gases like methane and some of the oil as well were respired by these organisms, that, again, like we were discussing earlier, it doesn't disappear.
Right.
That respiration process has to consume oxygen. Just like us, we need to consume oxygen as we respire our food. And in a substantial layer of the deep Gulf of Mexico had a very low oxygen, pronounced low oxygen levels over about 40,000 square miles. And so it was a very noticeable, very pronounced signature. At the same time, they're respiring out CO2. CO2, as it dissolves in ocean waters, actually reacts with water to form carbonic acid. So we actually see an acidification event of those deep waters. So yes, we are trading one evil for another. But nonetheless, we aren't getting out scot-free.
Okay. And so this research continues?
Without a doubt. Like I said, you know, we went into this with the hypothesis that methane would be there for decades from this release. That's not what our results are showing so far. So it was incredibly surprising to us. So a lot of our experiments right now are to better understand that process. What are the controls? What is the ultimate capacity for what we were calling this dynamic methane biofilter?
And so I guess what I'm taking from this is methane may not be there for decades, but that doesn't mean there's no consequence, and it's trying to understand sort of the eventuality of what happens with that.
That's exactly right. Okay. So we've got these releases of methane from the seafloor. In some certain circumstances, they can make it to the atmosphere. In other ones, they stay in the ocean. They could be converted to other greenhouse gases. They could influence ocean chemistry. All of this shows the interconnection, not just of one specific bubble that comes out of the seafloor, but of the entire ocean and the atmosphere and how that then also interacts with the terrestrial biosphere.
All right. So I've asked two of my three panelists what they're working on next. Let me finish up with Richard Eisenberg. What's next for you then in terms of your research? And then again, we talked about scalability and development. What's immediately next for you?
Well, we continue on with the process of trying to make hydrogen using sunlight, water. You need to have something that will absorb the light. You need to have something that will catalyze the actual formation of hydrogen. Basically, you need two protons, you need two electrons, and then you can get hydrogen. And as simple as this sounds, it turns out that this is not so easy.
It doesn't sound that simple, though.
And we need to do this using earth-abundant elements. It turns out that elements that have been used, like platinum or ruthenium or iridium, are not elements that are present in large amounts, and they're scarce, they're noble metals. We need to be using elements that are earth-abundant, and so we need to develop the appropriate light absorbers and catalysts that will use those elements. This process will continue, as will the independent development of the process of water oxidation. And then we'll have to take these two and merge them together so that, in fact, we can do genuine water splitting, the very old reaction of taking H2O and getting hydrogen and oxygen with the input of energy to do it.
Be fascinating to watch you continue to do that. Richard Eisenberg with the University of Rochester, thank you for the update on that, and thanks for all your knowledge this hour. Sakanya Chakrabarty from RIT, thank you for taking us through deep space and your explanations of dark matter as well. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
And thanks as well to John Kessler, the Kessler Lab, and fascinating work going on with you, John. Thanks for taking the time to come in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
It's a monthly science roundtable. University of Rochester and RIT coming together. Thank you for taking the time to listen on member-supported public radio. My thanks to engineer Mike Black. I'm Evan Dawson. See you tomorrow.